Welcome to Making Waves. On today's show, we have two artists that come from very different backgrounds. Lisa Jackson is an Anishinaabe filmmaker from Toronto, and Christine Webster is a composer and media artist from Paris. What they have in common is that they're both creating work for virtual reality that is neither a video game, nor a film, nor a musical composition. They are thinking of VR truly as its own artistic medium, with its own set of possibilities. We'll be hearing from Christine Webster in the second half of the show. Her work, The Empty Room, uses the unique spatial audio imaging inherent in VR as an integral element of creating an interactive musical experience. But first, we'll join Lisa Jackson. Her new VR film, Bidabin, First Light, transposes the landscape around Toronto City Hall into a futuristic time where nature overtakes and reclaims the city. In our conversation, Lisa underlined how Indigenous myths, symbols, and values inform the structure and imagery of her VR piece.
Well, it must be interesting to see it out there, you know, where the crush of the city is not so much.
Yeah, it's interesting. I thought that was interesting irony because this place is a kind of refuge from getting away from the city to getting, you could say, more situated in a natural environment. And so your piece is, you know, the natural environment taking over the city. So it's an interesting context for it.
Yeah. And I have to say that even for me, seeing it in situ there in Nathan Phillips Square in the same spot was more affecting than I thought it would be, given how many times I'd experienced the piece already. So that was kind of interesting. But it's going to have all these different kind of contexts, which is great. And I'm learning more about it as it goes around, because, you know, it just feels like this piece, people bring so much of themselves to it that, you know, you learn what it is kind of the more people see it and the more you hear about it.
So how is it that you think people bring so much of themselves to it? Is that have to do with partly the technology or the place of the story?
I think that the reason people bring different things to it is partially that it's so open to interpretation. You know, the closest relative to VR is kind of film, I guess. And film, I mean, both VR, my VR, Bidabin, and film have a beginning, a middle, and an end. But I would say, you know, is there a story, quote unquote, in Bidabin? I'm not sure about that. There's definitely a flow. There are things that happen in a certain order. But what those things, how they register with each person is a little bit different. And so I think, you know, especially we live in a society that's sort of primed for apocalypse stories or zombie stories or things like that. And so getting something that is a future state, we actually don't even really have much of a term for a future state where, you know, current structures are no longer in place except to call it an apocalypse, right? And so I think that depending on what your feelings are around being in a space that no longer has, you know, transit system or yoga studios or, you know, all these things, and that is crumbling in some ways, some people find that a joyous, wonderful place that they want to just spend more time in, and other people may find it a bit scary, although that's less common. But for sure, what people are confronted with, I think, are their own thoughts about what a possible future could be where nature takes over. And I think that it also stretches out too, with the inclusion of Indigenous languages and some what you would call traditional or land-based sort of ways of being in the city that you see in the piece. You know, there is a lot of evidence of people using the space, from the canoe and the underground subway tunnel to drying racks on the rooftop and, you know, agriculture and stuff like that. This idea that we're both stretching back in time to traditional ways And then looking forward, I think there's all sorts of assumptions that people bring as viewers to those two things. And they kind of have interesting collisions for a lot of people within the piece, right? And so it puts you in a place of really having to figure out how you feel about the whole thing. And that's not that common these days in any kind of film story. It does tend to be a little bit more contained. This is what you should think. This is what you should feel. Sound design in particular does tend to push us one way or the other. And we went to a lot of pains to keep it really open so that people could feel what they were feeling and not have it be directed too much by what the music was doing, or, you know, the exact tone of the piece was kept somewhat neutral.
I guess also the participatory aspect that people are in kind of control of how they navigate through the film. Does that, I guess that lends an element of authorship to the viewer that you wouldn't give in a film.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And, you know, one of the things I've found, I've done some VR, there's lots of room scale, which means you put up those sensors and it allows you to physically move around and have the environment, you know, maintain its authenticity within the headset. There's something about that. I get a bit queasy. I'm a little bit easier to get queasy within VR headsets. And once you can move around in this room scale way, I find it suddenly just feels like reality when you're inside there. And yeah, you're right. You do have agency. You can look around. You can see this. You can see that. The frame obviously doesn't end. It's all around you. And so, you know, that sense, am I missing something? Like a lot of our reactions are sort of in a regular movie is like you feel like you take in everything that's there. But in this, you get to sort of choose what you focus on and how long and how much of it you take in. And there is inevitably a bit of a feeling like you might have missed something, right? Because what happened back there? And so I think that and beyond that, I actually feel, and this is something I feel more and more aware of in this piece, is that the very physicality of the experience puts us in our bodies in a way that we often aren't when we're watching a movie or something. It's very visceral and physical. And because, you know, some people, you know, there's a couple scenes where people feel a little bit of a fear of heights, or they feel like their body feels kind of, at one point you're in the sky world, right? You're suspended out there. So those kind of physical reactions really center people in their bodies. And I actually think more and more that this is a really amazing tool from an Indigenous perspective, because a lot of us, we talk about, you know, becoming, you know, the idea of, being connected not just to our intellect, but to our emotions, our spirit, and our body, and the sort of balance that's a healthy balance between those things. And one of the things we detach from most easily in a lot of respects in the city is our physical body, right? We go to the gym for half an hour or whatever. So I think that this centering in the body is something actually very, a very good kind of, if you don't manipulate people with it, way to kind of get people feeling their body and also feeling the space they're in. Because a lot of Indigenous folks, and I've heard this a lot from artists, they talk about, you know, the access to us being connected to the land and our environment is actually being connected to our body first, right? So that is something that I've been kind of noticing, is that I think it just opens people up in a deeper way to have that physical sensation within the VR piece. And it sort of gets past their intellect, and their first reactions when going through the experience are visceral, they're emotional. Some people find it quite spiritual. And then the thinking part comes later.
Right. Yes, I would agree. I think that comes with seeing it multiple times. We had a big group here once on the weekend, and they all saw it several times through watching the others use it, just a flattened screen version for the other people. And they were picking up and noticing different layers of the piece and different aspects of the meaning and trying to puzzle it together as they saw it, you know, the repeated times.
Did anyone notice the turtle?
Yes, they caught on to that near the end, actually, and I hadn't seen it before either.
Turtle is very subtle. I laugh because the turtle isn't crucial to the piece, but it's one of those little things that is in there, and I'm kind of fond of the turtle, and but it is not everyone who sees it, so I always ask. But what I will, part of the thing is, you know, I think there's no right way to interpret what's in the piece, but totally literal level on one hand, and but also, you know, can have layers of meaning. And so things like the turtle, you know, the woman looks up at the moon, and that's when she has sort of some peace from her digging there in one of the scenes. And, you know, in a lot of, for a lot of indigenous people, the moon is grandmother moon, and offers wisdom, particularly for women, and is connected to the waters through controlling the tides and women's cycles and life giving. So, you know, there's sort of these symbol worlds that are more than just symbols that are at play in the piece, you know, going into the sky world or the connection to the stars. You know, on one level, it's just something that I found totally riveting, the idea of being in the middle of the city and being able to see all the stars if the city lights were gone. But also, you know, many creation stories from the Cree to the Mohawk to the Ojibwe say we came from the stars. You know, we're star people and we go back to the stars when we pass away. And there's various versions and, you know, different ways that that comes through. But, you know, having the star world, that's not a direct reference to any particular star story, but it is kind of in a broader way looking at all our relations, right? The idea of all our relations, which is underlined by, you know, the Thanksgiving address in the last scene.
I guess really that you had worked in VR before. So in a way, this piece was really conceived to be in VR from the beginning. And in a way, these kind of multi-layered meanings and really are almost only seem possible in this medium.
Yeah, I think you're right. Because, you know, I did, technically they would call it a 360 video that I did as sort of a director for hire for CBC's The Current. And it was about one story of a woman who lost her daughter on the Highway of Tears in northern BC. And that was more of a documentary kind of straightforward story. Like there's definitely a story in that, beginning, middle, end. It's very kind of controlled. But for this piece, yeah, it really suits this. And it actually grew out of, and you could call it a sister project to another project that I'm still working on, which will be done in about a year, called Transmissions, and a similar symbol world, but it's a large scale, three-part immersive audiovisual installation. You know, you would go enter into it, and you know, it covers a large kind of footprint, and but it also looks at language. It also looks at this idea of sort of a future, and a, you know, what the cities might become. I'm not sure if I should stop because I hear there's going to be a siren.
It's appropriate.
Yeah, I know. That's why I was going to keep going because it almost seemed like very apropos. So it is in that same world, and that grew out of, you know, I have been very interested in how indigenous languages within their very structures, you know, linguistically are radically different views on our place in the world. And I don't speak my language, which would be Anishinaabemowin, my mother's language, or Ojibwe. But, you know, 10 or so years ago, I really became fascinated with kind of researching. I read something that just for me was a eureka moment about how fundamentally different indigenous languages view everything. The worldviews are totally, totally different. And linguists, in fact, find North American indigenous languages very fascinating. I mean, Russian or Hindi would be far more similar to English than North American indigenous languages. And so that sparked off, you know, a few years of me really reading everything I could get my hands on, talking to language learners, fluent language speakers, teachers, all sorts of folks. And I had planned to make a conventional documentary about this, but it felt inadequate for the subject matter. And like, I just felt like I would be explaining that the very form of what I was discovering demanded something more radical in the way that it told the story of how these languages are different. And so I let that go, but then years later came back to it, realizing it would be amazing as an installation. And then shortly after that, realizing it could actually really also suit a VR. So the VR is a bit faster to put together than than the installation. So the VR has come out first, but the installation is going to be done in the fall of 2019. And looks like we'll be premiering it both in Hamilton and in Vancouver. So, but that was really where it came from. But the VR piece absolutely was about place. And I would say in a lot of my films, because I've been a filmmaker, place or a sense of place, what the tone is of a place, what the style or mood is, has always been really important to me. So this sort of took that to the next step.
I was wondering if you can talk about how the working with the VR team is different than working with whatever crew of people you would have for a film.
Well, I was very lucky to work with the National Film Board on this. My producers there in the Vancouver office, the team that I was working with were fantastic. And I have to say, it really is one of the amazing things about Canada having, you know, a public producer like the NFB, because, you know, their position is that, you know, this was a good project. I'm a storyteller. I had something to say, but they didn't require me to learn everything about creating VR, right? So they became my right hand and also sort of my translators as we worked with the technical company, Jam3, that executed the plan. But they were sort of the translators that I didn't have to go through a massive learning curve. I did learn, obviously, about the differences, but it was all kind of through translation, because we are working with an emerging technology. There are things that VR can do that are pretty impressive, but there's a lot of limitations. So even from the idea from day one, we agreed jointly that we would not compromise the quality of this world, that the top priority was a beautiful, authentic world that we would put people into. And even that pushes the technology of our day quite far. Like, you have to have a very powerful computer to run it, because when you combine room scale with the user moving around with graphics at such a high level as we have, it does really strain a system. And it works, but we're on the edge of it, you know, and there's user triggered elements with the text and things like that. So I was able to totally be an artist, you know, learning about what the parameters were technologically that I had to work within, but allowing the NFB to really take that and translate it to a technical group to execute well. And had I been that person, it would have been difficult, because I don't know that we'd be speaking exactly the same language. And my lack of understanding of, you know, how Unity, the video game platform that was used to create it, worked, or how porting, you know, Matthew's beautiful 3D visuals into Unity would affect, you know, design considerations. You know, those were really taken care of. And I think the reason that worked so well is that, you know, the team at the NFB also really fundamentally were connected to the creative in as, like, to the same depth that I was. So I had a lot of faith in their ability to do the translation. So in some ways it was like directing through, you know, those tin cans with strings, because, you know, normally I would be directing a lot of people more immediately rather than it going through levels. But there's always a layer of that, especially if you do fiction. You know, you're talking to department heads, and those department heads are talking to their crews, and, you know, it can just be unwieldy. As a documentary filmmaker, your crew is very small and you really see everything right in front of you. So I would say that's the biggest difference, and made me very, very grateful for my awesome team.
What would be future projects in the VR medium that you can see now being possible that you may not have realized when you set out on this particular project?
Yeah, well, for me, I don't know what VR may be in my future. If any, like now I'm sort of, I seem to always do something different. You know, I'm working on my first installation now and stuff like that. So there may be something, but I would say in general, it'll be interesting to see what comes. This piece has been, has been at the LA Film Festival, the Melbourne Festival. It seems to really be finding a lot of, there's a lot of interest in it around, and a lot of people are really feel like, I mean, one of the things that's been said is that you sort of use the grammar of VR to, in service of what you were trying to communicate, whereas so often the VR feels like it's attempting something, or it's not quite getting there. You're very conscious of its limitations or just the technology, and it gets in the way of the story. So I think that the idea of starting to discover from an artistic perspective what that grammar is landing. I think that for me anyway, I think the idea of creating a world that doesn't feel like a video game and isn't real, but is somewhere in between, I think that's a really rich area, because you often in VR, you get a documentary VR, right? Where they put you in a village in Africa or, you know, amongst a herd of buffalo, which is really cool too. Or you're in, a video game world, totally created, mm-hmm. and you feel that, you know. But this really manages to harness what's possible within, the computerized world to create something magical or, unreal, but layer it on top of something that connects to our reality. So I think that the idea that we could make worlds, and that the other thing that I feel, this is just me, is that, as I was saying, the physicality of it has been used, but people tend to, in my view, use it in a manipulative or gimmicky way, sometimes with the best of intentions. But, you know, putting someone in the middle of a war zone would be one example of, like, you know, we want you to know what it feels like to be in a square when a bomb goes off. And certainly that has a profound physical effect. For me, it seems a bit like extreme sometimes, right? Although it's effective, or putting someone in a refugee camp or an Ebola hospital. Those are some of the ways it's been used. And also, you know, even things like, let's put someone in the shoes of what it's like to be a black person in the United States getting stopped by the cops, right? So these things that are effective, but they're a little heavy-handed somehow. So the idea that we could be a bit more artful in what it means to be embodied within an experience like this, I hope that gets taken away. And lastly, although VR is a visual medium, people were saying in a more obvious way, a lot of people said, oh, we've been told you can't put text in VR. So there's language, right? There's written text in this VR piece. And it's more or less been said that that's not a viable thing. But I think the truth is, a lot of people who make VR, I'm sure the technology is getting better, but people drawn to VR are often, you know, people who do a lot of video gaming or are very visual. And so I think the text elements just don't necessarily resonate. But for me, it's not like I'm just praying for a lot of text in VR, but I think it opens a lot of doors. And, not that I don't think VR will ever be text-based, but for example, a lot of the documentaries take place in countries where they're speaking other languages. And for me, it's a bit offensive that they're almost never translated. There's no subtitles. And I feel like that's, as a documentary filmmaker, to me, that feels kind of disrespectful. But the argument has often been, well, you know, we can't put text on screen. So in a very kind of basic way, I hope that that trend shifts and we can, hear what people are saying, because I do think, like, you know, documentary filmmaking 100 years ago in VR, there has been a tendency for people of color to be in front of the screen, you know, as subjects, and white people to be behind. And the perspectives that are brought, sometimes, you know, they're not as ethical as I would like to see, like the voice and the full humanity of the people we see in front beyond their role as victims, doesn't always get highlighted. And I think that's a place where VR can really learn from what we've kind of been through in documentary filmmaking.
Yeah, I can definitely see a value in it, and as a outlet for documentary making, and that there is more more of a fluid screen space where things can overlap more than they can in the flat cinematic screen. That your piece certainly showed that that's possible.
Sorry, one thing that just occurred, just in one word, I would also hope that we can get more imagination into VR. I think that, you know, more art, more imagination, more, you know, meaningful, not just, you know, oh, let's do a kid's story, you know, in a flower field, which could be great, of course. But I mean, real thoughtful artistic approaches and people doing what I think of as sort of world creation, whatever that may be, and maybe people we haven't heard of before. So this has been called a piece of, you know, Bedaubin's been called, it is, Indigenous Futurism. But, you know, there's a lot of interesting speculative sci-fi style fiction coming from, you know, there's Afrofuturism and Indigenous Futurism. So there's really kind of fun and entertaining and work in the written word in particular. But I think there's a lot of room in VR to just kind of play with some meaningful background attached as well, where there's, you know, meaning to what these speculative worlds are about, in the same way that Bedaubin is just sort of gorgeous to look at and a thrilling experience, but there's depth in terms of what is, you know, what it's causing us to think about in our actual real world.
Yes, definitely. I felt that one of the beautiful aspects of the piece is that it's able to tell stories visually through very static scenes that come to life through the medium, but also through the level of beauty that you and the team brought to those. That I think that the poetic aspect of the medium, you touched on that, and I think that is a very rich area for future development.
Yeah. Lately, I've been saying all the time, it's not the what, it's the how. And I think that, you know, VR can give us a kind of a different how. It's a different, you know, is it... Anyway, and this gets back to what I was saying about the languages and indigenous ways of knowing. It's like, you know, the more I kind of occupy those understandings in my life, the more I think, you know, I think that there's a different way of actually just kind of taking things in. And even though I don't speak my language yet, there's almost like a different grammar. And I think that it's reaching, maybe Bedaubin in some way is reaching towards that sense of a kind of more connected understanding that would bring us closer to all the things that surround us and sustain us, and not just that, oh, you know, water or the stars or the plants are just there as materials for use, but, you know, a sense that there's a spirit to them, and we can actually be grateful and give that we are connected, you know, and not just a kind of nice to think about, but an actual way. So I think that it's not the what, it's the how. It's like sort of my motto right now.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's a similar difference from, I guess about 100 years ago, of film diverging from theater, that it was you could tell the same stories, but the way you told them were different.
Yeah, true, very true.
That was Toronto director Lisa Jackson speaking about her VR film Bedaubin, First Light. Lisa's emphasis on the how is picked up in our next conversation with Christine Webster. For her, the virtual reality medium extends the immersive qualities of electroacoustic music to a far greater extent than what is possible in concerts or other presentation platforms.
So VR is associated now only with 360 spherical film.
Okay.
And the VR, I'm making real-time calculation, doesn't interest so much people in France, because the film industry is very, very,
They want a narrative still, and they want to have it's basically a different screen that they're creating for.
I guess cinema is afraid, the film industry is afraid of VR, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
And even Steven Spielberg in the last film, he has shown Ready Player. He told, okay, guys, VR is cool, but don't go too much into it. You will lose yourself, etc. So at my point of view, the film industry is very afraid of the loss of the narrativity.
Right, but games are able to still contain a narrative element.
And games are still narrative, and so the disruptive aspect of VR comes from digital artists, musician or other kind of artist, and so we have to fight to take our place.
well, but I see it quite differently. I mean, I guess games are an interesting challenge to the traditional artistic media, because it is a creative medium.
Yes.
But it doesn't get the respect, I guess, despite its success.
Yes. Yes. Gaming is pejorative. How do you say that in English?
Specialization?
No, pejorative. Not good.
Pejorative, I guess. Maybe. Yes. But then there's lots of, I think, games that are very deep and very compelling. Do you see Empty Room as a game?
Absolutely not. It's the first thing I say when I do introduce the audiences to the experience. I say, first of all, it's not a game at all. So it's made with a game engine, but it's not a game at all. You have nothing to... You don't have to kill anybody. there are no monsters. You will not earn any gratification or money, or I don't know what. All the thing you see in games simply doesn't exist. And this is also an interesting challenge I wanted to test. So how could I take people's in this kind of simulation? And it's absolutely not a game.
Mm-hmm.
And everything works perfectly. I mean, especially the young person were very happy to have something to experience which is not a game, because they say often when we are playing games, we when we're going out of the game, we are very... nervous, aggressive, and and they say, oh, it was good to make this experience, because now I'm coming out of the experience, I feel very relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, interesting.
Do they think of it as a musical experience?
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it's an interactive one. Still, it's not passive.
Oh, nothing is passive in an empty room. I mean, because it's a little bit like a soundscape, or you have to be, you can be in a deep listening attitude, active listening, there's nothing passive in this experience.
Right. And I guess your role, besides listening, is to be a kind of spatializer? Is that the role of the listener or the user?
Just try to be as you are. I mean, you got 2 ears, use them. Mm-hmm. And there is not an evaluation of that, of your experience once you've finished. But the interesting thing for me was to hear from each person something different mm-hmm. when they came out, depending on their origin, gender, experiences or not with gaming or VR. And I've made 4,000 person have made the experience. And when I conducted them, I never heard twice the same experience from the listener. It's very interesting.
So this is definitely distinctively different than if 4,000 yeah. people heard your music at GRM.
Yes. First of all, I would never have been programmed at the GRM, first of all. And second...
Right. there wouldn't be 4,000 people.
No. The average is 50 or 100, but not much more.
But I guess the point though, is that is this these very individual responses you're getting that wouldn't be possible if it was a piece for a concert medium.
No. Because of the visual aspect, you have 2 layers of perception, so the sound and the visual, and these 2 layers combined give the opportunity to thousands.
But it's still an experience for one person, though, as opposed to a collective experience.
Oh, I started making my first experiences on Second Life, and I had... sometimes 60 to 200 person coming into my simulations. And from this perspective, I went on the Empty Room project on Unity 3D. My first prototype was made for one person, but we can be 5, 7, 20 if you want. There's no limitation.
Okay, so when those multiple people are using it, are they experiencing the same result or are they experiencing different activities?
Different results for each of person immersed, because depending on the on the position you are, you will hear something louder here, less loud at another spot on the platform. It all depends what you are doing.
Well, as a composer, do you find, is that radically different than composing for a concert situation in a public space? Or like where if I was seated in the back, I would experience the music differently than if I was sitting in the front. Is it like that or is it a much more dramatic difference?
Oh, no. I mean, I've composed... I started to compose with the constraint of the platform, and all the composition is made to be sensed from the platform and to have the impression you are sensing sounds beyond the platform. But at any point of the platform, you are hearing a homogeneous soundscape. This is another aspect of the composition in VR. I mean, you don't have a sweet spot. This means the sound must be optimal everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's nothing dramatic, or the sound is good everywhere from every spot you are listening at it, and the composition is made in this way.
So now, is the piece interactive in that if the user does certain things, different types of events occur that may not occur for other users? Or
no, for instance, the only interaction we got at this stage, because it's a constant work in progress, it's not finished, what I call the first interaction is movement. I mean, depending on the position I have on the platform, I will make a kind of mixing, you know, and my body and head orientation will attract me more to this or this kind of sound, or I can decide not to move at all. This is the first interaction. We want to introduce more tactile interaction, but in the future. This was, for instance, was not the problem.
So in a sense, could you create the same piece for a non-VR context in terms of the musical composition?
No.
So like everything down to the exact sounds that you're using and all that, that's all created for this environment, I guess.
It's really created for this environment, for the plasticity of this environment. I call VR and electronic music, it's a really a perfect match. And the qualities of VR space is plasticity. And we don't have this plasticity when we are going through loudspeaker devices, loudspeaker system. And this is one of the reasons I want to work into VR. It's precisely that you can achieve a specialization and composition you couldn't do in the real world.
Right. Yeah, I was kind of getting at how this was different. By plasticity, you mean like it's very a lifelike feeling, the way you hear in the environment?
Oh, it's plasticity at many levels. I mean, because you have you don't have constraint as a listener, as a composer, you are entirely free. I mean, from the ambisonic layer, we have worked with mono sound, stereo. In the second part of Empty Room, I've got stereo pairs which are shifting in the space. This is also possible. I've worked with quadriphony, octophonics responding each other. And I mean, all the whole thing I've put into this composition, I could never achieve it in the real life. Because the system which could do this simply doesn't exist. I had to made choices. Either will I work in octophonic or quadriphonic, that would have been a very a constraint with many constraints and no, definitively, it would not have been possible at all.
So in a sense, we're finally getting to a point where we can compose for loudspeakers in a way that we hear in the environment.
Oh, it's better
other than
that.
I guess, yes, better, because we can move the sounds around ourselves. We have that freedom.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, it's you can forget the loudspeakers in VR. You forget them totally. You don't see them. You don't have to. And it's completely something else. I mean, you don't think anymore, am I right at the right angle between my two stereo loudspeakers, or am I at the sweet spot, a good sweet spot in ambisonic? Because the very interesting thing is that with the ambisonic layer we have, there is no more sweet spot constraint either. I mean, normally, that's because the ambisonic layer coupled with an output in binaural is really the perfect tool, you know.
But then this is limited to headphone experience, though.
Yes.
Yes. So once we introduce playing this into a space, then all this goes away, I guess.
Yes.
But I guess within the virtual realm of the gaming engine, you can involve different listeners in different cities, different places at the same time.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, you could.
But is that just sort of a happenstance, or is that a desired thing? Is there something that would is there a value in multiple people hearing it at the same time? Is there a way for them to communicate or share in that experience?
Oh, they could completely communicate and share at the same time. It all depends on the quality of materials that we have at each end.
I guess the criticism for, you know, online experiences is that, well, it's not the same as being there in person. Like, I wasn't able to attend the conference in Germany, but I was able to listen in on the last session through someone's phone. and I said afterwards, well, you know, why don't we have more virtual conferences, you know? And then this is, well, it doesn't replace the going on a sound walk through a German village, you know. But in a sense, through virtual reality, maybe we could recreate that sound walk through a German village.
Oh, maybe. But my work is a little bit different than sound walking.
Right, of course. But I guess I'm getting at hyper sense, like the sense of the complexity of listening that happens in the actual environment, and getting to a point where we can achieve that in a virtual realm. Perhaps we'll step back a little bit and maybe if you can give me more of a general overview of the Empty Room project and its evolution through different mediums, because you mentioned you started with Second Life and other platforms in the past. How has the musical ideas and the composition behind it evolved through these different media?
So I started in Second Life with very simple techniques, I will say, using an amplitude panner, which was made for Foley. Mm-hmm. I don't know if the people will understand this. In gaming, in fact, music is comes out in stereo or in 5% surround sound. And only a little Foley sound for the Foleying are streetified with an amplitude panner, you know. And you got directional cues with this panner. I mean, so you can sense the sound coming more from the left or the right and more or less amplitude. So this mimics the impression of distance. Okay, that was the old tool I got, and then I was constrained to use a maximum 9-second audio files. And so at the beginning I saw, okay, 9 seconds, it's very constraining, but in fact, if you are looking at what you can achieve with Ableton Live and Clips, it's not much more complicated than that. You adapt yourself at the constraints, and I built my first sound, virtual 3D soundscape like this. And the other advantages I've got at this time is that as an avatar in Second Life, you can fly. So I could imagine my specialized devices sound mapping in every direction, I mean, below, above, flying, not flying. And this was another interesting aspect, and an aspect I could not achieve in the Unity session I'm developing now. Because we are completely immersed with the Oculus or the HTC, and I cannot really make the rendering of flying also interesting as it was in Second Life.
I suppose as you switch from one medium to another, there's things you lose and other things you gain.
Yes, but with the time. Yes, because starting working on Unity was starting everything from scratch. So my experience from Second Life tools, I take them with me and I try to form the same kind of situation and tools, and from this we are trying to make our next projects will be much more complex. We are working step by step, but we are working from scratch, right?
And what is it that keeps all these projects under the name Empty Room? What is it that they have in common, even though they've got completely different sets of constraints and possibilities?
If you're going on my website, the other project I've made in Second Life doesn't called Empty Room. There was a lot of projects, of five projects, I guess, if I remember well. And no, Empty Room is only the project we made on Unity.
Oh, okay. Maybe I got confused, but you referred to there being different evolutions of Empty Room.
Yes, there are different versions, because it's a constant work in progress since 2015. End 2015, we have made the first exhibition and a VR room, showroom. And since this time, the project is in constant evolution.
Okay. But the artistic goals of the project have remained the same through that evolution.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And what are they? What are those goals?
The first goal was to deliver to a much wider audience an electroacoustic composition made in VR, because when I was in Second Life, people are great in Second Life. I met a lot of fantastic people, but it's not easy to use. So through VR showrooms, I could touch a very different kind of audience. And especially I noticed, and this was also a kind of proof for me, that when you associate VR and electroacoustic music, it goes like a breeze. I mean, people are completely into it. They like the music, they like the kind of sound. But these people would never have been able to go to a concert of the GRM or things like that, you know?
Right. Is there something, and is it that they wouldn't know about the concert at the GRM, or they wouldn't find it an experience that they would value?
They didn't know it, and they wouldn't find it. So with one experience, suddenly a door is open. You know,
I guess it's because they understood the VR context. Is that why?
Mm-hmm. The VR context facilitates the audience to go into electronic and experimental music.
Because you created also a visual landscape that you navigate through. So is that part of what makes this experience accessible to people interested in VR?
In this case, yes, it participates to give the wow effect. Okay. Mm-hmm. But I could completely imagine making a project without all this graphic design around.
Could you have a piece that does happen in darkness, or?
No. Darkness. I don't like darkness in this case.
Right. Well, I mean, I just was curious because the in terms of, or at least a context that is oriented by the sound. I guess that would be the acousmatic argument. I suppose would be having something that is situated in the where the sound comes first. I guess.
I'm too happy to have a space to exploit. So mm-hmm. why would I shut down the light? It's no sense for me. I know a lot of digital artists working with sound in VR, making very dark ambiences. You don't see much, but this is not really interesting to me. I like to show things, or to show very simple things. But
do you think we're coming to a point where the divisions of
like you're a visual artist or you're a composer and you're a dancer, and you know that these kind of divisions are gradually dissolving, and that really in the future we will all be multi-talented artists that can, like in your case, incorporate visual design and music together as one language.
In fact, VR is multimedia. Mm-hmm. It's the best multimedia tool, in fact. So, because you can integrate pictures, film, 3D objects, whatever you want, text. You can imagine everything you want. And now with super duper specialization and episodic, you can unleash completely your music. And well, it's I think it's the best tool we have now.
And with all these multimedia aspects of it, does it require a team to create a work rather than one individual?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't achieve this. I mean, when I'm composing music or preparing my music for improvisation, or I can do all this alone in my studio at home. Doing Empty Room, no, it's not possible to do everything alone. You have to be involved with a team. And so far, I guess we have 10 persons who have worked on this project.
But I guess you've also studied graphic design and other video and other formats, so you've kind of have a language that you can share and understand and speak with.
Yeah.
So people without that knowledge that you have, do you think it's possible for them to work in that way as well, or is this something that's an opportunity that's come to you specifically?
Oh yes, I've started at the beginning before I made music. I was a graphic designer and was a painter. maybe this facilitates what I'm doing now. And then I went into electroacoustic music, and then I worked as a sound engineer in post-production, audio post-production. And so VR was a kind of tool that emphasizes all these abilities I had, I guess.
But I'm wondering if the students coming in through school now have a bit of these eclectic interests already, that they know a little bit about how to make music with a computer, and they know how to, you know, do stuff in Photoshop and with video programs and things like this, and some gaming experience that really, in a way, that you're just ahead of them.
Yes, but my experience, and especially on Empty Room, is that you have to work in a team and with people who are good at what they are doing. Because if I take the example of the coding, code is the only thing I do not approach, because it's too much work for me, too time consuming. It's so I contact each time I need it a brilliant coder, and this person in 1 or 2 hours make me the code I need. And it would be too long for me to do that. And why I'm saying this, because we really need to work together to with this kind of tools.
But it still takes your experience in these different art forms to kind of be able to imagine it. And I would think that.
So I'm a kind of director, in fact. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, if you want to take comparison with something, yes, I'm acting like a film director.
That was composer and media artist Christine Webster from Paris, speaking on Making Waves. Making Waves is heard here on WGXC Monthly, and it's produced by New Adventures in Sound Art. It is also available through Stitcher and other podcasts.
Tonight, sweetie, I'm making you your favorite meal. It's the least I can do after an entire week of taking away your phone, going through your messages, calling you names, insulting your friends, and shouting at you. Yeah, tonight, I'm making you your favorite meal so I can start another week of taking away your phone, going through your messages, calling you names, insulting your...
Violence against women stops here. Contact SOS Violence Conjugale. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Intended for all Quebecers. We must take extreme measures to curb the pandemic. Only essential services remain open. Gatherings are prohibited. It's forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. These efforts aim to protect our healthcare workers, seniors, and loved ones. Let's comply with the lockdown and curfew to lower the risk of contracting COVID-19. Because our health is important. For more information, visit quebec.ca/confinement. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Do you know about love? What do you possibly think you know about love? You know, I'm sick and tired of men using love like it's some kind of disease you just catch. Love should have brought your ass home last night.
Welcome to the spot.
Welcome to the spot.
The spot is where I kick it.
Got a lot on my mind, I'm thinking I need
you. Bring me joy when I'm down. Also,
oh, that's great. Yes, y'all, welcome to the latest episode of The Spot on CKUT 90.3 FM. The Spot is where I kick it every first and third Monday right here. The Spot with Miss Nikki, man. Listen, I'm excited. I'm excited today. Excited to have you all here. Excited to have you listening because